welcome to today's Living on the Edge podcast. I'm delighted to have as my guest Lisa Hellman. She's research leader at the Center for Dependency and Slavery Studies at the University of Bonn, where she leads a research group exploring the coerced circulation of knowledge. They're also a Pro Futura 15 fellow. Lisa's won several awards for her research and is probably most well known at the moment for her fantastic first monograph, The House is Not a Home, that explored the European community in early modern Canton and Macau. Recently, though, their research has shifted towards fascinating global histories of Central Asia, which I hope we'll be hearing more about today. Thank you for joining me here today, Lisa.
Thank you so much for having me.
As I understand it, your research interests are tied to the big question, really, of how intercultural exchange changed the lives of men and women who were involved in this process. And I was just hoping to start, could you expand on this and tell us a little bit about your current research? Maybe just with the basics. What region and period are you focusing on?
Generally speaking, I have been working on the long 18th century. And before, I worked a lot on southern China and the maritime ports there. But recently, I found myself been shifting inland to what I think is the really exciting region of Central Asia. So what is modern day Kazakhstan, Mongolia, Kyrgyzstan, Turkmenistan, and of course also the Chinese region of Xinjiang, and this how this region developed in the late 17th and early 18th century.
That is a fascinating area of research, and it sounds like the questions we could ask are probably as vast as the region you look at. But really, to try and pin down for our topic, how do you fit this theme of border making into your research? Where does it crop up?
Well, it both is very much there and very much absent. And I think that what makes it so exciting. Because one of my main topics of research has been the Jungar Empire, which was a nomad empire, a sort of loose confederation of a lot of Mongol tribes. And they did not conceptualize borders in quite the same way as the more sedentary polities around them. So they, instead of controlling land, the idea was to primarily control people, which of course then, as China expanded, the Qing Empire did its massive expansion inland, and then the Russian Empire did its own massive expansion over Siberia. We have two sedentary empires clashing with this semi-nomadic empire, and they have completely different conceptualization about what is a border, what would we use it for? And of course, the fact that the nomads might not have found this important doesn't make it any less important for the Russians, rather the other way around. So that has been, for me, a very fruitful way of trying to understand what is happening when these empires clashed.
That sounds brilliant. Can I just follow up quickly with, if the Dzungar have a very different conception as they are a semi-nomadic empire, would you suggest that Russia and China are approaching this with fairly similar border-making practices? Or are they also offering contrasting understanding?
Well, I mean, it's obviously not completely similar. One must also remember, of course, that at this point, the Qing Empire is also a Mongol Empire. So while that has, of course, been integrated in the larger Chinese framework and also making use of that Chinese long history territorial framework, they are also making use of ideas from a nomad heritage. From the Russian side, I would say that one of the most important points to remember is that their expansion into Siberia is a territorial expansion, it's a commercial expansion, it's a military expansion, but it's also a religious expansion in which mission becomes a really important factor. That is not quite as crucial from the Chinese side, although, of course, religious legitimization is. And that's a reason why in the Dzungar Chinese conflict, Tibet always comes in as a major factor and a way to for these empires both to legitimize themselves and a place where they clash. But mission per se is not really part of this border making.
Okay. And within this then, the Dzungar, you've said that they have a different sort of intellectual interpretation of what a border is or not in their case. But what sort of processes of border making do we have from this example? Are there any examples that spring to mind?
I do think one can look, for example, at both the tax collection and the way that that changed, because in these borderlands, we have many different smaller polities, and some are closely connected to the Dzungar ruling group of this federation, and some are very loosely connected to it and hardly do more than pay some furs now and then. And a lot of these local rulers found absolutely no trouble in, well, no trouble, that's not to say they liked paying double taxes, but they didn't think it was intellectually strange to pay taxes, for example, both through the Russian Tsar and the Dzungar ruler, or on the other side of the border, both to the Chinese and the Dzungars. But then as we go into the 18th century, as we have more and more regulated borders between the Chinese and the Russians, suddenly the Dzungars have to adapt to this. And this takes several different forms. We have a linguistic difference in how you talk about spaces. We have different practices of how you relate to the land. But we also have, of course, the military pressure where Chinese and Russian troops are trying to say, here's where we're building a fort, here's where we have an actual physical border, and then the Dzungar troops reacting to that. So I see border making in a lot of different ways, I would say.
And within that, you've mentioned here hard sort of physical borders with the forts that I presume introduced practices of control that might be more comparable with the Russian or Chinese examples either side. But before this, what exactly are the borders that do exist on a cultural or religious level around the Dzungar? What are they trying to control? Is there a control of the movement of people? Is there an effort to regulate trade? Or is it fairly free and easy going?
Well, I wouldn't say that any lack of a formal line does it easy going, makes it easy going anyway. But I think you mentioned commerce, and I think that's a good example of the ways in which they thought about their own outer borders and the way that they would regulate these. Because as the empire expanded, it also came to control several oasis towns where they would also be trade hubs. Now, these trade hubs would be under control of several different Muslim groups. These were not taking over by the Dzungars, but they were taking out hefty, hefty payments from these towns. So that means that the way that they controlled foreign trade was through assigning it to particular places and also to particular groups that would then be given a particular role in their empire. This was not something for the Dzungar nobility or for the Dzungar people to do. Similarly, they would forcibly move, again, a lot of Uyghur people to different parts of the empire where they would push to agricultural labor. This, again, might not sound like necessarily a border-making practice, but it's actually a direct effect of the pressure that the Dzungars faced from the Russian Empire, from the Chinese Empire, from the Kazakhs. They realized we need to be a different kind of space. We need to be a different kind of empire. So they actually shifted from nomadic to semi-nomadic with a stronger focus on military production, but also on agriculture. And that agricultural labor was coerced labor that also came from other regions of the empire. So again, they are controlling a certain group that is doing a certain thing in the empire, and in that way kind of clicking into a new making of empire that was also very much connected to assigning certain groups certain types of labor.
And I imagine with these other groups that they're connecting with, Islamic merchants or individuals participating in labor, do we see interactions with those communities also creating other types of border sort of within the Dzungar context?
We certainly see them reshaping space. In a way, we see loan words shifting, but that we also see as not just within commercial contexts, but also within military contexts. A good example there of this sort of border making as also an ethnic meeting would be when the Dzungars invade the Kazakhs. the Kazakhs actually adopt several different Mongol words, including Aymak, which is a word for a certain type of region. And this can be compared to when the Russian empires then invade the Kazakhs slightly later. And then the Kazakhs adopt other words, this time from Russian. So I think we see a constant interaction here between the commercial, the cultural, the linguistic, and of course also the military.
Absolutely. And I think what you're describing is something that really helps shift the focus away from the state, especially the nation state, towards either individual participants or different sort of social stratification that helps create these borders as they were in this environment. Could you say a little about how you approach the research for trying to get to grips with these individuals? What sort of sources can we use?
Well, that's a very good question, because the Jungai Empire is today not one of the most well-known. That's also partly because it wasn't a strong literary culture like the Chinese, and it didn't have the same tradition of record-keeping as did the Russian Empire. It was, however, it did have a script. While being primarily an oral culture, it did have a script. They created their own Ururat Mongol script in the 1640s, and they wrote legal text in this. They translated loads of Tibetan Buddhist scriptures, but also a lot of Chinese technical texts on medicine, on astronomy, on history, on literature. But of course, this doesn't necessarily tell us so much about the day-to-day workings of the empire. So for that, we have foreign visitors, we have Russians coming in, we have a massive group of coerced labor coming from throughout Eastern Europe, even Sweden, the Ottoman Empire, Persia, all flowing into the Jungai Empire, working there. Again, some of these have produced texts, most didn't. We also have the Chinese texts, but they were the arch enemy of the Jungars, one could say. So, of course, the Chinese official records would not be the kindest in their interpretation of Jungar culture or what they do. So, in a way, we have a wealth of sources. On the other hand, we have sources for not necessarily the things I would be interested in finding, or from the actors I would rather hear speaking.
Do you think there are strategies that you can use as an historian to try and engage with those individuals despite the difficulty of these sources? Are there particular methodologies that you use or imaginative leaps that you try to take?
Well, I'm trying to leap as little as possible, but what I do think that actually the combining of this is where it happens. So if one would only look at the Chinese sources or only the Russian sources, you have two winning sides talking about the loser, because of course eventually the Jungars were completely eradicated in such a way that they were even taking away from the maps. This is in a way quite similar to the way that Central Asia disappeared in a way from the imaginary during the Soviet. This region has been very unfortunate in its geopolitical position, because it keeps being forced to disappear. And that also means that there has not been the same type of interest in trying to dig up, for example, dig up sources that really talk about this, because there is a lot. And I do think that if we only combine these sources from the coerced laborers, for example, for prisoners in the Jungar Empire, when we have travelers traveling through that, when we have the Jungar texts, even if they are of a normative nature, when we have that together with the descriptions from the winners, then we are starting to get, if not a full picture, then at least a better picture.
One of the comments you've made in your description of these sources is just the amount of people from different places all around the world who pass through Jungar lands. And it sounds like migration is something that's incredibly important to this story, which often is not the case in terms of border-making studies, in terms of sort of this fairly free movement of individuals, even if they're participating in labor regimes in the way you describe. Do you think that the Central Asian Jungar perspective of migration is something that's radically different to perspectives of migration in other parts of the world? Is there a unique context that you're looking at in Central Asia? Or do these similar questions, would you suggest, apply across different global historical perspectives?
I think this is one of the times when I would like to say, this is, Asia is not unique. In a way, quite often when we have been talking about coercion, even coercion to the degree of slavery, Asia has sort of taken a slightly less central position. And the general view that we have is, I mean, the most typical would be of the chattel slavery of the Atlantic. I think by instead looking at Asia and the various different forms of coercion there, indeed, the entire spectrum of coercion that is not so easily disentangled, because slave, serf, coerced labor, even just a servant, these terms are not necessarily easily translated or understood. And if we then put that side by side with the fact that we have huge migrations within China, within Russia, some of these are exiles, some of them are forced, some of them are semi-forced, coerced, some of them are prisoners who are being moved, then we suddenly realize that just as we have big groups of people being moved in the early modern period across the seas, we also have them moving across the lands, and that the process of globalization, this nice web of people being tied closer and closer together, always had this darker side of people being forced to globalize, so to speak.
Absolutely. And I think in the way that you describe this, would you suggest that this is a uniquely early modern process? Is there some reason why this period saw such widespread movements of people? Or do you think it's just something, the more we dig, the more we'll find is just sort of part of human history?
I definitely think it's to some degree, it's the more we dig, the more we find. But there is also something particularly exciting, I think, about the early modern period because of this increasing entanglements between regions. I'm not contradicting the fact that there is a shift of something of a qualitative nature in somewhere between the 16th and the early 19th century, if I may be so specific. But I do think that it does connect the world closer together. The one thing I'm suggesting is that that shift was not necessarily a very nice one for everyone, and it was certainly not a voluntary one. And what I do think is nice about the Junggar example specifically is that that also shows how these flows of coerced labor are also the same as the flows of commerce. There's more and more research being shown that this idea that the Inner Asian Silk Route, of course, is a much later word, but the Inner Asian trade routes, they did not decline when the Europeans started their maritime trade. They shifted, but they were absolutely still vibrant and important, even crucial for how these regions interacted with each other. They might not have been as crucial for the Europeans, but not many people in this region cared very much about how the Europeans felt or what they did. Scott Levy has done wonderful work on this, and also really showing how vibrant these routes were also in the 18th century, how this story does not end when the Europeans take to the boats.
Would you suggest that the continuation of the, as you say, what's become known as sort of the Silk Road trading routes, is there something that when we talk about histories of globalization, I know there's been a fair amount of work talking about how we could sort of centralize globalization in China as sort of the end destination or point of interest for so much of this. But is there an argument to be made for sort of expanding this and looking at globalization through a Central Asian perspective?
I mean, I'm supposed to answer yes, right? I'm supposed to say, yes, we should recenter everything in Central Asia because that's really the heart of the entire Eurasian continent and that's where things are going on, which I do think this is an absolutely crucial region for the religious development, for the exchange of technology and also for the way that migration develops, and not the least for how the different empires play out against each other and how in the end the entire power shift of Asia changes between Russia, between the Jungas and the Chinese. However, what I want to say is, do we really need more centers? Isn't this part of the whole multiple modernities or the idea where we need to prove that there are several processes of modernity instead of questioning what are we even using this word modernity for? Or in that sense, saying, no, the European world was not the center for early modern globalization. Actually, it was China. Instead of saying, do we always have to have one center and then everything else is periphery? Isn't that the problem to start with?
I couldn't agree more, I think, on that note. And it's useful, I think, to break it down in exactly the way you describe of multiple centers overlapping and entangled globalizations, if you want to use the term. I feel like we've moved away a little bit from some of the specific Dzungar examples that you introduced at the start. So I'd just like to briefly return to these and the point you mentioned about religion. And I just wanted to ask if you could expand on how Dzungar, when responding to these encounters across their borders, what role did religion play in justifying or in creating or solidifying the borders which we're talking about?
Religion was hugely important. The Dzungars were primarily members of the Buddhist, could be translated as the Yellow Hat sect, which is just a particular kind of Tibetan Buddhism. And in order to legitimize their rule, they also became what we would recognize quite well from early modern Europe in the same period. That is, they became the defenders of the faith. So when, for example, Tibet came into conflict with China, or the Dzungars thought that they came into conflict with China, the Dzungars invaded Tibet to defend what they thought was the rightful Dalai Lama, for example. That was also what the Chinese did. So this idea of religion became a bone of contention between them, but it also, of course, affected very much the Dzungar relations with the Mongols. That in this way, religion also became, in really a quite horrible contrast to the present day, a way for them to relate to the Uyghur agriculture workers within their land, who of course were a Muslim group. And when the Qing Empire eventually would legitimize the fact that they had conquered the Dzungars, even exterminated the Dzungars, they legitimized that with how badly they treated the Muslim Uyghurs. So the Chinese presented themselves as saviors of the Uyghurs who were suffering under this Dzungar yoke, how they were treated as slaves. And of course, looking at the Muslim population of China today, that does come out quite horribly in contrast.
Yes, and I think the process you're describing, would you suggest that through religion there is the increased development of borders in ways that might seem more familiar to a sort of notion of the nation state or imperial state? Or after moving into Tibet to protect or to impose their own religious ideas, did the Dzungar then withdraw to sort of their traditional borders, sort of separate from that?
I don't think that that particular contact was so much a way to change the way that the borders were conceived, so much as it was a way to protect their own sphere of influence. So I think in a way, these sort of religious conflicts played very well into, so to speak, the cosmology they already had. A much bigger problem for that cosmology then became the conflicts with, for example, when the Chinese, after the Treaty of Kyakta with Russia, they felt that the border with Russia was so set that they actually put down physical stone markers in the ground. This sort of thinking, this sort of cosmology, one can discuss whether that is religious or not, that is a completely different way of thinking. The same when the Russians in the same period would say to the people of the borderlands, you have to choose, you are either Chinese or you are Russian, which of course took away the entire chance of saying, oh, but I'm also belonging to the Jungar Empire. I'm also paying taxes to them, for example. So, and of course, that also fits into a Russian idea of what an empire is, and also would eventually fit into the very religious idea the Russians had of Siberia being their promised land.
And with the development of this stronger or strict, more delineated border with Russia, do we know how the Jungar responded to Russian efforts to standardize this through things like building forts? What was the process there?
Well, I mean, in case of the Russians building their forts, the Jungars, as long as they could, actually raised them to the ground. Then when they could no longer do that, they also negotiated some access to some Russian actors. For example, Russian mining engineers were allowed into the land to look for gold because there was a great rumor in Russia that Jungaria was also a land of gold, which again fits very nicely into this idea of Siberia as the promised land full of riches and so on. So this was a way in which the Jungars, so to speak, allowed some access. They would also later even ask for certain experts, particularly artillery experts from Russia, in order to counter the threat from China. So in a way, they would also try to play out the different polities against each other, the Kazakhs against the Russians against the Chinese and so on. And a way of doing so could be to let in certain groups into the empire and even to invite them. The mining engineers didn't do very well. They didn't actually find anything. But they were invited.
Which is, you know, something, I guess. I mean, in terms of this, as you say, the destruction of the forts and this sort of very limited access across the border doesn't correspond really with the movement of people and migrations of labourers that you described earlier. You've mentioned, of course, that the Jungar in the end were destroyed. The Jungar Empire ceased to exist. But I don't know if the question is, why do you think this border making practice was unsuccessful? Or perhaps was it successful at certain periods? I mean, is there a point where the Jungar Empire, you would say, is effective in developing a sort of border making strategy?
That certainly depends on how you define success and, of course, how long success has to last. I mean, this was, in a way, a fairly short-lived empire. It only formed from the 1620s and 30s and then had its heyday in the early 18th century. So it forms reasonably quickly, and it does also manage to consolidate reasonably well. Again, it has its legal code. It starts to formalize the commerce within the empire. It starts this entire shift towards agriculture, which is really a major shift in the entire thinking of the empire. And it does hold its own against both the Kazakhs, the Russians, and the Chinese at the same time. I would say that's definitely a very successful polity. But no, it couldn't last, and it didn't last. And there, of course, we go into alternative history. What other things could have happened to make this more successful? Well, who knows? Had the Chinese-Russian border conflict dragged on out more, then perhaps the Jungar Empire would have survived longer. Then again, one can put it the other way. The reason why the Russian and the Chinese did manage to form an agreement, not just once, but twice, over their northern borders was because of the pressure they both faced from the Jungars in that region. So in a way, the strategies they used were perhaps not bad strategies, but they were exactly the same strategies of consolidation and tighter territorial claims. They even created maps, territorial maps, which was a completely new practice for them, but they did so in conversation with the Chinese maps at the time, with Russian maps at the time. So they used the same practices. Perhaps they just did it slightly too late or with the wrong competitors.
What you're describing is some fascinating research. And there are lots of questions I'd like to ask more about that, especially in terms of international trade. But I will resist to ask you, I know over the course of the project that we've been working on together, we've been thinking about border making methodologically and securitization methodologically. I was wondering if you could reflect on how they've been useful to you in your analysis of the Xungar Empire?
Well, I think both have been very useful, but in different ways. I think border making and also thinking about borders as a process has really helped me in a very concrete way to find the problems I always have faced with trying to think about early modern history, especially early modern history outside of Europe, in a historical framework that is still very much centered around nations that are supposed to have a starting point and an ending point, which is, of course, not even the case in Europe. So in a way, I think border making and focusing on that is exactly what we needed to get away from the nation. Similarly, actually, as when gender history says, let's focus not just on men, but also on women, there's a way of focusing on men as the norm that actually gives us a lot of information about the gender relations at the time. Similarly, focusing on the actual borders makes us understand what is a polity, what is a nation, that is maybe even better than to just try to pretend it's not there or trying to sidestep that entire issue. And in doing so, I have found this idea of securitization, that is, that it is also a cultural process, an emotional process to create a border, and not primarily even a legal one. And I think that has been very useful for understanding how this would happen in practice.
Yes, I think there's certainly something useful there about sort of pushing the way that we imagine these spaces in different directions. A final question. We've touched on global history, globalization as historical topics during this conversation. If I could push you just to answer the question, what do you think is the most important next steps for this as a developing field still? What do you think we need to do as global historians to move to the next level?
I mean, in that case, I would like to come back really to, well, three different points that I've touched upon already. One is that we need to include more overland context when we talk about the early modern period, because the more we talk about the maritime context, the more we run the risk of talking about primarily European expansions. Not that these weren't important, but they are also the ones where we have the easiest to access sources. If we instead think overland, as indeed you do in your research on the Mughals, we get other parts of the story. The second step would be to say, not all of these global history stories are particularly nice ones. They are completely intertwined with coercion, with very problematic gender structures, and of course, with friction, with silences, and even with practices of slavery. So I would like to see more about the bad part of globalization. And I think in doing so, we will eventually be able to get away from the story of who was the most important actor or what was the most important center. Because I think to some degree, we're still stuck in some sort of Wallisteinian idea where there needs to be systems and systems need to have centers. And as soon as we do that, we will start to favor one flow over another and one central development over another. And I think what it can be equally interesting to look at the things that didn't quite happen. Or, for example, a Central Asian empire that didn't really work out that well in the end.
Yes. I mean, all of those, I think, are fascinating points and certainly suggest there's a hell of a lot more work to be done in the future.
I think so.
Of global history studies. And I think that is a useful and intimidating point to finish our talk. So I'd just like to say thank you, Lisa, for taking the time today to speak with me. And please, any listeners, please check out the other podcasts available on the Nordic Global History Network. Thank you very much.
Thank you.